Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. I am trying to remember that I wear a microphone that is about half an inch from my mouth. I don't know why it is when I'm in this larger room that I constantly try to yell at the back wall. Maybe it's to keep Rich awake. I'm not sure because most of the time he falls asleep. But I'm going to try to remember today that I don't need to do that. In fact, this microphone is much closer to me than the microphone in the other studio. So I should speak even more quietly. But I don't. And probably by the end of the program, I will be yelling at the back wall again. It's just, I don't know, it's just sort of the way it goes. Good to be with you on this Tuesday. It's going to be a crazy week for me. I actually get to do, we've had scheduled at Apologia Church some LDS evangelism training. I'm not sure if most people know, but we have people out at LDS ward chapels every Sunday, not only here in Phoenix, but up in Salt Lake City as well. And so we've had this training scheduled for a while, and Sunday afternoon during the announcements, when that was being announced, Jeff sort of leans over to me and says, "Hey, are you in town on Tuesday?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He says, "It's my daughter's birthday." I'm like, "Oh, okay." So I haven't done that for a long, long time. So I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be exciting. We're doing that this evening. But lots of stuff going because, honestly, I'm less than, about 4 weeks out from the next trip, which could be almost as long as 3 weeks. Hopefully see you all in St. Charles. And it looks like right now going to have some speaking opportunities in Amarillo, Texas, Lubbock, Texas, which aren't all that far apart, except that it's Texas. So that's like four countries apart for most European countries. it really is. I mean, Texas is just huge. It's massive. But we'll be letting you know a little bit more about that as that comes along. But especially our regular trip to St. Charles. So I hope those of you in that area, we frequently have people who travel and they want to see what new Kuji sweaters I've come up with in the course of a year. And we still did it last year. I drove out there in my little Subaru. This time I'll be driving out there and bringing my accommodations with me, as they say. You can help make that happen. That gas tank's getting more and more expensive as we go along. Thank you to the CCP-run Biden regime for that. I assure you that is absolutely positively purposeful on their part. I have on the screen something that just breaks my heart, to be honest with you, but I'll be honest with you, I do not understand what has happened to the minds of the people of my nation. It is like the magic glow juice from the government is just the most awesome thing that has ever come down the pike, and everybody has to have it. And so here is a woman who is a series of tweets where she says, "I'm a teacher with a few science degrees. All three of my kiddos will be vaccinated as soon as they are able." Now, I just stop and I go, okay, I realize that from the beginning of all of this, the vast majority of Americans had never looked at mortality numbers in their lives. And we had. You can go back and look at The Dividing Line. Some people might say, "You're weird. You always looked at mortality numbers." Yeah, I have. And I've also studied the Black Death. And I think part of that goes back to Psalm 90. You know, it's better to spend a day in the house of mourning than a day in the house of feasting. And we are to pray that the Lord would teach us to count our days. And we need to recognize, one of the reasons that Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was so effective, even though it was not preached with a tremendous amount of inflection in the voice, is because it spoke to a reality that I've spoken of many times that is missing in our experience, but that was a part of every generation before us. I mentioned when I preached on the Reformation at Apologia on Sunday afternoon, I'll be preaching again this Sunday, I'll be continuing the baptism series, but I mentioned at that point in time that everybody in Luther's, everybody in Wittenberg had seen dead bodies, not just within their own families, but lying on the side of the street. There would be times when plague would come through. Mortality was something they understood. They understood what the numbers were. We hide from death. We hide from the numbers of death. When you actually tell people how many millions of people die in the United States each year, they're stunned, they're shocked. And then when you start breaking that down as to what the causes are, well, then you can start getting an idea of what the risk assessment is. And that life has always been a risk assessment. It's never been the safest utopia that, not safest, but the safest. That is the utopia created by the religion of safism. The safest utopia has never existed and can't exist. It's impossible. And so when you look at the danger represented to young people, to children, and the novel nature of the magical potions that are being foisted upon us to the tremendous enrichment and empowerment of a particular group of people. And this is where people start blinking out. They just won't even think about it. They won't. Sure, they've heard about these massive spending bills and how much government money, and, well, these are all free. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Anybody who thinks something the government does is free just has no earthly idea that they shouldn't be in a position of making decisions in society. They don't understand how things work. But these magical potions, clearly, we know now, have a very, very, very short period of effectiveness. They are diminishing in capacity, which is why you've got the next round coming up, and then the next round after that, and the next round after that. And there's clear evidence that it's diminishing our overall immunological response and capacity. And so that's going to lead to all sorts of other diseases and things that go along with that. But it's simply not a danger for children. There are so many more things that are a danger to children. Riding a bike is more dangerous to a child than this particular disease is. But since people don't think about that kind of stuff, they don't have any way of weighing things. And so when you just listen to a particular mantra, a particular narrative over and over again, it eventually completely bends the way you think. And so here is a mother with a few science degrees, whatever that means. All three of my kiddos will be vaccinated as soon as they are able. For what reason, we're not told, but that's what being a good person is. And so here's her son and his vaccine card. And then it says, my son was one of the unlucky ones, and he developed myocarditis after his second dose. He was monitored in the hospital for 3 days. I am not making light of it, and I can't pretend to know what pain he felt. However, I asked him if he is still happy to be vaccinated. And I saw in another, this is a different way that it's unrolled. I saw in another one that said that he was, which is just amazing to me. And then she says, okay, I'm not an expert. As a parent, I don't think that the risk of myocarditis and its severity is being adequately conveyed. I had no idea that mild meant 4 days in the hospital and cardiology visits for the indefinite future. Different issue, I guess. I have to pay for my son's hospital bill and endless cardiology follow-ups because he got post-vaccine myocarditis. That's not free. Twitter is brutal. From the beginning, I have advocated for vaccination as I believe it's a way to control this pandemic. I stop right there. It's not. Never has been. Never will be. Can't be. There are so many medical experts who have testified to this reality and can point to history. We have never, ever, ever vanquished a respiratory virus through the use of vaccination programs. It's never happened and never will. The fact that we are having to develop new vaccines and then new vaccines and then new vaccines demonstrates you will always be minimally 6 months to a year behind where you need to be. You will always be giving shots for what made people sick a year ago. That's the reality of where we are. And all you know, the whole reason we're going through this is because certain global elites who were put in positions of power by ignorant politicians in some cases, Donald Trump, and corrupt politicians in other places, Joe Biden, well, Joe Biden doesn't know what he's doing. So the people around Joe Biden, I would say Kamala Harris, but she doesn't know what she's doing either. So the people who control, who pull the puppet strings on the regime, they're continuing the power of these individuals. And we have the video. We have the video of these very people, of Anthony Fauci on C-SPAN 2, lamenting, complaining about how long it takes to get any type of new technology through the process. Take it, he's like, it would take 10 years. Well, he found a way around it. Found a way around it. I think it's a crime against humanity, but he found a way around it. However, when I share that my son got myocarditis from his vaccine, I get blocked. I'm sorry, my son's AE doesn't fit your agenda. And then she shows some of her bills and says, this does not account for his follow-up visits, echoes, EKGs, MRIs, stress tests, troponin levels. It's very disheartening that the vaccine, and then for some reason it's not showing the rest of it, and I'm afraid to click on it because I'll lose it all. Sorry. But the money. Lots of money. My son's new shirt came for immunity, and all I got was myocarditis and a mask. Well, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but that's what it says. I used to shame people for not getting vaccinated until my son was hospitalized with vaccine-induced myocarditis. Life has a way of humbling you. But then there was a late addition. Same woman. My daughter will likely still be getting vaccinated after I discuss it with her doctor, which everyone should do. It's adolescent and young adult males that have the predisposition for this AE. I feel for this particular young lady, this young mother. I really do. I do not wish to mock her or to in any way, I don't know. It just seems so very, very sad to me that someone could see this, could see what is happening here, and then still go, well, we need to still do this. I don't understand it. The simple self-deception is astonishing and shocking. It really, really is. But this is what we're experiencing in our world today. And it is very, very sad. Just briefly, it is an astonishing thing to listen to the rhetoric coming out of Glasgow. I guess that's all over with. So they've all burned up a few more million pounds of hydrocarbons to get where they're going to get back. But I actually heard, and I didn't verify this, but I actually heard that that the prince claimed that he has had his Aston Martin converted so that it runs on wine and cheese. That this is serious. And I'm like, I hope he was just making that up. But to listen to these people, man, is Boris Johnson a disappointment? Oh, goodness. You know, so many of us were excited because he promised to get Brexit done, but then he's turned out to just to be a complete globalist coward. It's illustration of what happens when you have someone who's allegedly conservative that doesn't have a Christian worldview as the foundation of their conservatism. It will collapse, especially in the context of the secularism that we're dealing with today. By the way, if you do pick up, if you have the time to catch Sunday night sermon, I thought it was sort of important. I tied it into the sermon that I preached at the Castle Church in Wittenberg in 2017, which is interesting. That was well before, that was a few months before I started, you know, that's before the MLK 50 thing and people started using woke and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But still, my concern at the time was we have changed. The matter, the truth hasn't changed, but we've changed. And in many ways, the peasants of Wittenberg, who rushed forward to receive the Lord's Supper when it was offered to them in both under both kinds, both the bread and the wine, were in many ways significantly more advanced than we are today as secular people. They had a significantly more real understanding of the world and what was important than the people we deal with today in our society. And so I basically made the argument Sunday afternoon that while the Reformation needs to continue, it needs to continue on an even more basic level. I have lamented for many years, as was pointed out by, I think it was John Murray. Let's say it was John Murray. If I've got the name wrong, I apologize. But I remember reading a wise man saying that the reason that the proclamation and preaching of justification by faith no longer rings the bells of men's hearts, is the way it was expressed, is because of the fact that mankind no longer lives in the reality of his own mortality, the reality of the day of judgment, and especially now lives in the dehumanizing emptiness of the secular worldview. And sadly, many people come into our churches and they still have that worldview, and we are not challenging it. That needs to be one of the primary things that we do when we are presenting the Word of God to people, is to recognize that they're spending most of their life exposed to this soul-rotting religion of the culture of death. That's what secularism is. It is the religion of the culture of death. It has nothing else to offer. If all you are is a cosmic accident with no transcendent meaning, then you're going to get tired of me saying this. But hopefully once you hear it and start seeing it, you'll see why I say it. But secularism, as it exists today, is the greatest enemy that has ever reared its head against the Lordship of Christ since the stone was rolled away from the tomb. And we have to be mindful of that and recognize that. And so the Reformation has to continue at a more basic level than it did in the days of Luther, because our people now exist at a more degraded level in their understanding of spiritual things, or even their recognition there is such thing as a spiritual thing. Think about it. So that's available on YouTube at Apologia Studios if you want to listen to that. I was a little disappointed. I actually went 1 hour and 2 minutes. I was going to try to make sure to go under an hour because the week before, Jeff had done, I think he did 1 hour and 29 minutes. And so I was going to try to demonstrate you could do that with a little more alacrity. But I still went 1 hour and 2 minutes. So it's strange how that works. And even though we had a chili cook-off coming up afterwards, and so I knew that there was pressure out there, because there are all those, I mean, we had at least 3 generators running out there to keep all the hot pots or whatever it was running out in the outside the building. So I tried to get us done and at a decent time. All right, so I want to go to the big board. We're going to go to the big board today. What was that? Is that something like an ESPN or something? Go to the big board or something like that? I want to sort of pick up on and continue from a week ago when, remembering, of course, that I don't do theology anymore, that I just simply wear a MAGA hat and praise Donald Trump all day long. That's what some people actually want to try to say. But last Tuesday, I felt that we addressed something that's incredibly important. And what we discussed was the decree of God. The fact that when you read the Christian scriptures, starting in Genesis through Revelation, when you see, for example, it's a big area of study in biblical studies these days of what's called intertextuality. And when you look at how that applies in sound believing theology, especially to the relationship of what we called Old Testament and New Testament, I think those are somewhat bland terms because there's so many different kinds of literature in both the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian Greek scriptures. But one thing that I have often emphasized is the fact that there is this beautiful tapestry of divine truth with these threads. I almost wore a kuji today, but I felt that the jacket would be a little bit better today. But you know I love color. And when you look at a tapestry that has been woven with purpose, you see how the threads mix with one another, and sometimes they'll disappear and they'll come out in another place. And because they're in another place against another color background, they look different, but they're the same threads. And when you see how, for example, the book of Revelation is just soaked with Old Testament terminology and typology, and which is why I think so many people have no earthly idea what's going on in the book of Revelation and end up with Apache attack helicopters rather than seeing the quotations from Isaiah or something like that, or Ezekiel, some of the favorite places to quote from. Anyway, it's a testimony not only to the inspiration of Scripture written over 1,500 years and in multiple languages, but it's a testimony to the reality that God has a purpose and that he is accomplishing that purpose. And that purpose hasn't changed. The application, the people he's been working with, the scope certainly has changed as that purpose has come to fulfillment. Once the Messiah comes, once you have the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, now the gospel goes to the whole world. But that was his purpose from the beginning. And so you see the consistency of the fulfilling of God's decree. And I want you to remember that we pointed out last week that in one of the most popularly cited texts of the Old Testament in the New Testament, Psalm 2, I will tell of the decree of Yahweh. And what is that decree? That decree is who Christ would be. His coming, his work, his exaltation. And then we saw in Ephesians where you have it just laid out. You know, God's summing up all things in Christ. This is his eudaikia, his kind intention, his good will, his boule, his thelematos, his will, his desire, his plan. It's all about God, and it's all found in him. And its central aspect is Christ. But how many things are bound up in Christ? We tend to think of, well, you know, that whole story, that's just one little part. You know, it's just this thing over here. Can you imagine how many things came together to produce the fulfillment of messianic prophecy? All the people, all the decisions, all the quote-unquote free actions of men that for over, in the case of prophecies in Isaiah, 700 years led to the fulfillment that they led to. This is a decree that orders the very fabric of time. This tapestry does not have any threads. They're just going off this direction, going off that direction. It isn't some type of thing where, yeah, God does the big stuff, but he doesn't sweat the little stuff, because the reality is all big stuff is made up of a tremendous number of little stuffs. Anybody who studies history knows this. Anybody who studies, you know, the large battles of the past knows that almost all of them turned on some of the smallest things. Some of the smallest things. I've often thought of, and I've told a story more than once, that I took a young lady out on a date in 1981, and bought us pizza, and for the whole evening, I narrated to her in perfect detail and in chronological order, as best you can, the entirety of the Battle of Midway from World War II. And we got married 15 months later. And so knowing history, it's very important, young man, keep that in mind. I was 19, she was 18, we got married, so there you go. Anyway, that battle turned on some amazingly small things. It shouldn't have gone the way that it did. Americans were badly outnumbered. But the Americans had cracked, and when I say cracked a code, when you crack a code, you don't just sit there and read the whole message. You discover bits and pieces, so you're able to piece things together as best you can. Well, we had cracked, to a certain level, the Imperial Japanese code. And so we had identified where they were coming from, and so we were in ambush. But when you think about all the things that had to come together, when you think about, at one point, we had sent all... We did not have the experience the Japanese had by any stretch of the imagination at this point. We had launched everything from our carriers. And they weren't finding the Japanese. And the fighters had gotten separated from the dive bombers, which had gotten separated from the torpedo planes. You're supposed to attack all at once. That never happened. And our torpedo planes just got torn to shreds. The Zeros were much faster than those poor little torpedo planes. They just got mauled and destroyed. But the only reason we won that battle was at one point, I think it was the dive bombers from the Enterprise. The Enterprise was an aircraft carrier, not a spaceship back in those days. And looked at the clouds and saw a single Japanese destroyer. But they could tell from that altitude it was at full speed. It was going as fast as it could go, which means it wasn't protecting anyone. It wasn't looking for a submarine. You don't look for submarines when you're at full speed. You can't hear anything that way. So since it was leaving a huge wake, that means it was trying to catch up. And so they go, let's go that direction. And lo and behold, they went that direction and found the entire Japanese Imperial Navy and dive bombed. And between the three squadrons, Enterprise, Yorktown, and Hornet, sank the Akagi, the Kaga, and the Suryu. Here you survived, but it was sunk the next day. Anyway, point being, one little thing, that what had happened was one of our subs had found them, but then they depth charged it, and they had left that one destroyer searching for it. And once it gave up, it's like, okay, I gotta get back to mama. And that was like an arrow. One little thing, one little code thing here, one little incident there. The Suryu's number four, was it Hiryu or Suryu? The number four plane that went out on a search pattern. The radio went out, radio shorted out. They happened to be on the exact vector where the American carriers were. And they couldn't get a message back until they landed again. That delayed the counterattack long enough for us to win the battle. Item after item after item after item. You can't just simply do the big things. I mean, God could control tsunamis and earthquakes, natural phenomena. But when you have free creatures involved, there has to be something far more than merely knowing what free creatures will do in certain situations. So all of that to take us to Isaiah chapter 40, if you want to take your Bible, I want us to think about what the scriptures say here about God's knowledge, about God's knowledge. Let's start in Isaiah 40, verse 3. The reason being, I want you to see what this text is about. A voice is calling, clear the way for Yahweh in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Sound familiar? It should sound familiar. This, of course, is quoted in the New Testament as a prophecy of not only the ministry of John the Baptist, but then who is our God who has come, clearing the way of Yahweh in the wilderness? Who comes from the wilderness? Well, Jesus does. Let every valley be lifted up and every mountain and hill be made low. Let the rough ground become a plain and the rugged terrain a broad valley. Then the glory of Yahweh will be revealed and all flesh will see it together, for the mouth of Yahweh has spoken. A voice says, call out. Then he answered, what shall I call out? All flesh is grass and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of Yahweh blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news. Lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. Was all this fulfilled in Jesus? Behold, the Lord God, Yahweh God, will come with might, with his arm ruling for him. Behold, his reward is with him to and his recompense before him. Like a shepherd, he will tend his flock. In his arm, he will gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes. Who is measured? Now, here you have the promises. Here you have the promises that are being made. What has to be the foundation of these promises? What will encourage the people of God? Well, the truth that their God is truly sovereign, that he has kingly freedom, and he will be able to accomplish what he promises, even though the fulfillment was literally hundreds of years down the road. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales? Now, remember, last year, I think somewhere around there, we dealt with some openness advocates who actually look at this and go, see, God learned stuff. God's learning stuff here. He may have made the mountains, but then he has to weigh them afterwards to find out how big they are. That's literally what some of these people, I mean, that is so far removed from anything. It's really hard to respond to it because it's just so silly. But there are actually people that are that silly. Who has directed the spirit of Yahweh, or as his counselor has informed him? Seems Paul like that text. With whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding? And who taught him the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him with the way of understanding? The answer to all of these questions, of course, is rhetorical. There is no answer because no one did. He is the source and fountain of all of these things, of all knowledge and understanding. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust. Even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. Now remember, this is being spoken into a world where most of these nations had their own gods. Their own gods. And what was so incredibly offensive about the teaching of the Jews is that they were saying their God is the only true God, and all other gods are false. To wet the old whistle there. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. A goldsmith plays it with gold. A silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot and seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the vault of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Now I stop for just a moment. And if there's a possibility of dropping in a few, that would be great. We sometimes pass by these texts, but what does it take for God to reduce rulers to nothing and judges and make the judges of the earth meaningless? What is required there? I noticed in looking at this that when it says meaningless, over here in the Hebrew, it's katohu, And you may have heard when Genesis describes the initial creation, wohu tabohu, empty and void. What does it take for God to do that? In other words, there has to be an ability on God's part to create the very fabric of time so as to not be controlled by his creation. He is accomplishing his purpose in creation. And if it's his purpose to reduce a ruler to nothing, to make judge of the earth meaningless or empty or vain, that can take, that may require God's actions to begin long generations before the fulfillment of the action. He has to know what takes place in time perfectly and then order it perfectly to fulfill not the will of men, but the will of God. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stalk taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them and they wither and the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me, that I should be his equal, says the Holy One. Now, do you get the idea that there is something about God that is absolutely unique? There is something about his knowledge that is absolutely unique. Any philosophical system that seeks to limit God's knowledge to a set of syllogistic conclusions that is not informed, first and foremost, by the text of Scripture, will lead a Christian astray, can never arrive at true Christian truth if you do not start where you need to start. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. The one who leads forth their host by number, he calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing. Now, we know that at the time this was written, the author could not possibly have conceived of the number of stars that actually exist. But remember, this is the same author who gives us messianic prophecies that have been fulfilled. So if you are hesitant to believe what he has to say, maybe the way you should look at it is, well, here is a promise that has only gotten greater in its fulfillment over time. And in fact, over the past 100 years, now we have come to understand the vastness of God's power in this area. We knew nothing about other galaxies up until fairly recently. Even though you can literally, on a good dark night, if you've got good eyes, you can literally see the Andromeda galaxy with your bare eyes. It's a little puffy thing. No one realized it was another 100 billion stars in a galaxy very similar to our own. And now we know there's 100 billion galaxies, which cannot be seen with the naked eye. But because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. He has a purpose for all of them. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel? Now, at this point, now that you have this greatness of God, you now have the application to Israel's situation. My way is hidden from Yahweh, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God. So in other words, if he can order the entire created universe, do you really think that he is not intimately aware of what his covenant people are doing? Do you not know, have you not heard, the everlasting God, Yahweh, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired? His understanding is unsearchable or inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for Yahweh will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not grow weary. Somebody will someday, I'm sure, make that a very popular plaque at a Christian bookstore. Well, okay, they already have. Coastlands, listen to me in silence, and let the peoples gain new strength. Let them come forward, but then let them speak. Let us come together for judgment. Who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet? He delivers up nations before him and subdues kings. He makes them like dust with his sword, as the wind-driven chaff with his bow. He pursues them, passing on in safety, by a way he had not been traversing with his feet. Who has performed and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, Yahweh, am the first, and with the last, I am he. So God is accomplishing something in the days of Israel. He is bringing forth Cyrus. He is changing the world political order for his purposes, purposes that would be very important in bringing the Messiah into this world. He knows what's coming. He knows that it's going to be Rome and not Babylon that's in charge when Jesus is born. That's his purpose. And so he is accomplishing that purpose even hundreds of years before it's going to come to fruition. So when it says, calling forth the generations from the beginning, the point is his actions transcend simple points in time. They last for entire generations because he knows what he's going to accomplish down the road. He knows how everything has to fit together. He is working things in time. I, Yahweh, am the first and with the last. I am he. Now, if that sounds somewhat familiar to you, that's because over here we have in the Hebrew Anahu, which is the Hebrew background to Ego Eimi in the Greek Septuagint, which then is used of Jesus in the New Testament. The coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near and have come. Each one helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. So the craftsman encourages the smelter, and he who smooths metal with a hammer encourages him who beats the anvil, saying of the soldering, it is good. And he fastens it with nails that should not totter. But you, O Israel, my servant, Jacob, who I have chosen, descendant of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from his remotest parts and said to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not rejected you. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous hand. Behold, all those who are angered at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. You will seek those who quarrel with you, but you will not find them. Those who war with you will be as nothing and non-existent. For I am Yahweh, your God, who upholds your right hand and says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Now, I won't go into a discussion right now of the necessary discussion of who is being addressed here. And are we talking about faithful Israel? Are we talking about the remnant that will be saved in the future? These are all issues that come up frequently in Isaiah because there will be a switching back and forth. Do not fear, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I will help you, declares Yahweh, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I have made you a new sharp threshing sledge with two edges. You will thresh the mountains and pulverize them. You will make the hills like chaff. You will winnow them, and the wind will carry them away. The storm will scatter them, but you will rejoice in Yahweh and will give glory in the Holy One of Israel. The afflicted and needy are seeking water, but there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst. I, Yahweh, will answer them myself. As the God of Israel, I will not forsake them. I will open up rivers in the bare heights and springs in the midst of the valleys. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land fountains of water. Let me continue promises here. I realize time is passing me by. I want to get down to verse 21. So after the promises that the Lord, the hand of Yahweh has done this, the Holy One of Israel has created it, then you have, present your case, Yahweh says. Bring forth your strong arguments, the king of Jacob says. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. As to the former events, declare what they were, that we may consider them another outcome or announce to us what is coming. Now, this is a verse that I've addressed many times in the past, but it hasn't been for a while. So please make sure you're looking at Isaiah 41, 21, and 22. So, the gods who are tempting Israel into unfaithfulness are being addressed here. And they are put in the witness stand. And Yahweh says, present your case. Bring forward your strong arguments. Bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. So first and foremost, having established in the previous chapter his creatorship and his providence, his upholding of that which he has made, as well as the fact that history is being unfolded as he himself has indicated and can now reveal to his people. Now he says to the idols Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. Now, he has said, I am the first, I am the last, I'm with the first generation, I'm with the last generation. In other words, I am will always be the I am. There is nothing taking place in time that is a surprise to him because he's the creator. Not because he possesses special knowledge from some other source, but because he is the creator of all things. How can he not know what he himself has created and created perfectly for his purposes? So let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. They can't do that. They are just as lost as to what could take place tomorrow. Every day we wake up and look at the news and go, well, I didn't see that coming. Well, sometimes you go, yep, saw that one coming. But then other times, like, whoa, okay, not what I expected. But then there's a phrase here. As for the former events, declare what they were that we may consider them and know their outcome or announce to us what is coming. There is, I think, one of the most important texts in the trial of the false gods, Isaiah 40-48, trial of the false gods. It's not just trial of false gods, but that's its primary thrust. That, I think, is, as for the former events, declare what they were. That's what a historian does. So is God saying to the idols, be a good historian? Is that all? Well, sometimes that's not easy to do. Even in the modern period, there are still questions. I mean, any battle in the Second World War, give you an example, and my focus, for some reason, has always been, I mean, it's not that I haven't read lots about the European theater, but primarily in the Pacific. You know that, like, there are at least five good major works just in the Battle of Midway, and they disagree with each other. That was less than 100 years ago. And there were lots of survivors to interview, and yet still there are questions that have not been answered as to exactly how things happened. So as for the former events, declare what they were is a little bit trickier than you might think, but more importantly is that we may consider them and know their outcome. That we may consider them and know their outcome. There's what the historian can only guess at and can only make provisional statements about. And God says, I can do that. I can do that. I can tell you what happened in the past, and I can tell you why it happened. That means that what takes place in time is purposeful. But where does that purpose come from? God says he knows, but nobody else does. And so if the meaningfulness of actions is derived from anything other than the will of God, you're going to have a problem with this text. Or at least, on the absolute minimum, what the scriptures is telling us is that God's knowledge of future events is a knowledge that is intimately connected with his will and intention in bringing those events about. No purposeless evil. No purposeless evil. Or announce to us what is coming. Declare the things that are going to come afterward that we may know that you are gods. That's how you find out what a true God is. God, a true God's the creator of these things. A true God can do these things. But declare the things that are going to come afterward that we may know that you are gods. Indeed, do good or evil, that we may anxiously look about us in fear together. Now, folks, if you can't recognize sarcasm, there it is. There it is. This is God sarcastically mocking idols. Indeed, do good or evil, do something that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. Oh, that's what you've got here. This is full on in your face sarcasm. No question about it. How do I know that? Because the next verse, behold, you are of no account. You are empty. You have no meaning. You are of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is, And here's the Hebrew right here. Toeva. Toeva. An abomination. An abomination. Same term used of homosexuality in the holiness code. If you choose idolatry, you are an abomination to God. Strong words from the same prophet who gives us the prophecy of the coming of John the Baptist that we know has been fulfilled in the life of John the Baptist and Jesus. So if that happened in the past, why should we question its authority today? So you see, this is the in-depth, beautiful theology that already existed before the first words of the New Testament were ever written. This is what Paul's drawing from. This is what Jesus is drawing from. This is what Peter is drawing from. Why is this important to us today? Well, we are certainly looking at a situation today where, I'm just going to go ahead and use this. I could probably find a snazzy way to do it, but this will work. Why is this relevant? Well, most of you who are theologically adept know what I have been talking about sort of in passing. Historians will tell you that from the time really of Augustine onward, yes, even Thomas Aquinas actually agreed on this subject as well. That's a very, very controversial topic these days. But up until the time of the Reformation, Christian theologians, in thinking about the knowledge of God, had recognized that, oh, really? Is it almost? Just look at the watch there. When I do it this way, the clock on the computer is about 4 points smaller than my eyes can now see. So it's worthless. Christian theologians had, in thinking about the knowledge of God, had divided it into what we might call his natural knowledge and his free knowledge. All right? And on this side, on the natural side, is God's knowledge of himself. So God knows himself perfectly, unlike creatures. He does not have to learn things. We learn things about ourselves all the time. God is not in any learning process in any way, shape, or form. There are people who believe that. There is something out there called process theology, which is, whew. Anyway, God has all knowledge of himself, and God likewise has all knowledge of what he could do. So, If God knows himself perfectly, then he knows what he is capable of doing, and he knows what any act of creation that he could bring forth would look like. And so this would include knowing what kind of creatures he could make, how long they could live, what their capacities and abilities would be. And of course, most importantly, and this is where I fear that very often the conversation does get somewhat lost. What's most important in sound biblical theology in thinking about this is God and his purposes. If it is God's intention to demonstrate his attributes, his wrath, his power, his justice, as well as his love, his mercy, his grace. This creation is about God. And as I read so much of philosophy, it's not about God. It's about mankind. It's about putting God into the categories of mankind. I see it all the time. And so the natural knowledge of God would be about God and what God can do. About God and what God is going to accomplish to reveal his attributes. That's the natural. The free knowledge of God is his knowledge of everything that he has done in creation. And so we could have right here, could put a line here, and this is the decree of creation. And so when we talk about the relationship of these what are called moments in God's knowledge, we're not talking about chronological things. We're not saying that this comes before that chronologically. These are logical moments. They speak to the relationship of these moments in God's knowledge. And so once God has created, then he has free knowledge, which is knowledge of everything that has taken place. And that would also include a knowledge of counterfactuals. What do I mean by that? Well, we have illustrations in Scripture. God tells David, yes, Saul would do X, Y, and Z, therefore get your tush out of there. If such and such had happened, then this would happen. But this is all after the decree. And so this is based upon the fact that God knows what Saul's going to do, not only because God knows all of time, but God made Saul. And God created Saul in a certain way. So, for example, isn't it obvious that in Saul's experience, isn't it obvious that in Saul's experience, the fact that he was a big man, that he had great physical prowess, don't you think that entered into how Saul did things and responded and acted? It did. But who made Saul tall? Who made Saul tall? Who called Saul? I don't know. I never watched that TV show either. God did. So it's after the decree. So it's a counterfactual. Saul would have done this, but he didn't do it because it didn't actually happen. It wasn't what God's decree said. But the point is that it is a result of God's choice, which is right there. This is where God's will and choice is seen. And so that free knowledge results from what God has chosen to do. So what has happened since the days of the Reformation? Well, really, it was more of a period of time post-Reformation and counter-Reformation, is that there has been an insertion of what is called middle knowledge. Middle knowledge. Why is it called middle? Because it's between God's natural knowledge and his free knowledge. That's why it's called middle. Doesn't seem like the best terminology, but, there wasn't anybody in charge of creating terminologies back then, so you go with it. And this middle knowledge, which no one had really thought that God needed before, some people will actually attribute some development of this to some Anabaptists, but most people would say that this is the creation of Louis de Molina, who is a Jesuit. And the Jesuits, of course, were tasked with finding a way to counteract the Reformation. The Reformation was preaching strongly God's sovereignty in the affairs of men and in salvation, and this undercut the Roman Catholic system of the sacraments, and especially the synergistic system of the Roman Catholic Church. And so what you do is you come up with this idea that God has a special kind of knowledge, middle knowledge, And what middle knowledge allows God to know is what any... Now, this is what's interesting to me is this. This is only relevant to man. It's only relevant to free creatures, quote unquote. It has nothing to do with anything else. And all of creation has nothing to do with stars or galaxies or anything. It's just all about man on planet Earth. And what middle knowledge does is middle knowledge tells God that if you have John Smith, okay? We've got John Smith over here. And John Smith, if God places John Smith in any set of circumstances, so if God creates a world where John Smith lives in the 20th century and is lives in Europe, in Germany, John Smith, well, he wouldn't have the name John Smith, would he? Yeah, well. but
he lives in England.
Yeah, okay, we'll move over.
Okay,
he's over in England. John Smith will join the army and he will be in the Air Corps. Because this middle knowledge gives God infallible knowledge of anything John Smith would do, no matter when John Smith lives, in any world that God would place John Smith. Now, let's think about what all that means. Because John Smith doesn't just pop out of the air. John Smith is the offspring of an entire line of people. So, how could you know? This is something we got to keep in mind. How can you know these things? But whatever world John, and one of the most important things is, God would know which worlds in which John Smith would accept Jesus and which ones he wouldn't. And there's even discussion that God would know that there is no world in which John Smith would ever accept Jesus. That's interesting. So this middle knowledge, you need to see, is before this line. It's before the decree to create. Because middle knowledge then serves to delimit the possible worlds that God can create. So because he has middle knowledge, God can run all these massive numbers of scenarios where he has every possible person and he knows what every possible person will do in any given situation, whatever age they're put in, whatever. And then he comes up with a decree of creation. Now, there's disagreement amongst Molinists, people who follow Molina. There's disagreement as to exactly what the algorithm is. That's how we describe it today. He's running the numbers. Is he going for maximal number of people saved? Is he going for maximum amount of good? Does he go for a balance between the maximum amount of good and the least amount of evil? They don't know. And the reason they don't know is, as soon as I drew this, I stopped talking about the Bible. Because there's nothing in the Bible about this. I mentioned counterfactuals over here, but there's nothing about, there cannot be, by definition, anything about middle knowledge in the Bible. Why? Well, proponents of middle knowledge will make reference to, for example, the Saul incident in Matthew 11 and stuff like that. But that has nothing to do with middle knowledge. It can't, by definition. It's post-decree. Middle knowledge has to be before the decree, or middle knowledge becomes irrelevant. Why do I say it becomes irrelevant? The only reason to come up with middle knowledge is to find a way to artificially say that God is sovereign and man is autonomous. The cost of that is to say that there is this middle knowledge that defines what every person will do. Every person will do exactly this and nothing more in any given situation. But John Smith here is known by God before God decrees to make John Smith. That is the key assertion of middle knowledge. There's some proponents of middle knowledge don't even want to talk about this. They sort of want to do the C.S. Lewis mere Molinism type thing. They don't even want to try to substantiate this. Because the reality is what Molinism is based upon is the assertion that there is some source that defines what every free creature would do in any given situation. And it's not God. It can't be God, because then that would be on this side of the line of the decree. So back here to John Smith. God has not decreed to make John Smith. And yet somehow God knows what John Smith will do. But you and I both know that so much of what we do is based upon God's decree. There are certain things that have never entered into my mind because God never created me to be able to do those things. I have never been tempted to be a mountain climber. God didn't make me that way. So that's not gonna enter into anything, but it's part of the decree. And so all of our decisions are based upon the gifts that God has given to us, the inheritance from our family, from our progenitors, our ancestors, the context in which we've been placed. And all of that is a part of what? It's over here. It's part of the decree. So how can God know? How can even God know what a free creature he has not designed or defined would do in circumstances he has not defined or created? Well, it's all hypothetical. But if it's all hypothetical, here's the problem. This middle knowledge in Molinism determines what worlds God can and cannot make. So when he is looking at possible worlds, he is limited in what worlds he can make by the content of middle knowledge, which does not come from his Eudokia. Make that an alpha there. No, that looks terrible. Oh, hey, I can erase it that way. That's pretty. I like that. There we go. It doesn't come from his Eudokia. It doesn't come from his boule. It does not come from his will. We don't know where it comes from. It just is. It's just something God has, except it limits God. And it limits his choices. By putting it before the decree then becomes limited to what God is allowed to do on the basis of what has been determined by middle knowledge. He cannot decree to make a world in which all are saved, because there are certain people that, according to middle knowledge, will never be saved. So who determined that? This is the issue. And oh my goodness, the lengths to which our Molinist friends will go to stand on their heads and use empty language and never get around to. I have a clip that I'll eventually play for you, where a well-known young Molinist today just is asked this direct question: how does God have knowledge of what a free creature will do when God has not decreed the very nature of that free creature, what his intelligence is going to be, what anything about him? his physicality, his spirituality, his intellect. Our decisions are all determined by these things, and they all come from the decree. You have this weird idea that men and women are can somehow be reduced to some kind of floating ethereal thingy-me-bobby that gets defined by something out there we don't know, and God goes, oh, that's what those things are going to be. No. That's why up until this point in time, everybody had thought natural and free, that covers it. Everything God can do, knows himself perfectly, and everything he's done, there's nothing more. You stick this in here for one reason, and only one reason. So that you can pretend that you have an autonomous creature. That it's pretense, it doesn't work, but that's what you're pretending to do. So the issue that we have now seen in looking at last week, Ephesians 1, Rich is having way too much fun with the cameras. Have you noticed this today? Where, you know, he's bopping over. We've got three different cameras, and he's decided he's going to use all three cameras. And so I'm sitting here trying to stay focused, and I'm do you hear that? Did you hear that? What was that? Was it Muttley? What was that? Yeah, that's the. Was it Muttley? Was that the laugh in the background? There we go. See, we're dating ourselves. Most of the people in the audience go, "What are they talking about?" I don't know. It was going fine till just then, my screen went out too. I've been going so long, but here's the issue. Where does the definitional content of middle knowledge come from? When you do not have the decree of God, because in the moments of God's knowledge, it comes prior to. You can't appeal the decree. So how can you have a disembodied, undefined, undecreed John Smith and yet know exactly what he will do in any given set of circumstances? That makes John Smith into something the Bible never describes any of us as. Did anything we just read from Isaiah even smack of anything like that? Is there any evidence whatsoever that any prophet, any apostle ever even dreamed of this? None. Absolutely none. And yet, you have people today going, that just answers all the questions, doesn't it? And they really believe that it does. I mean, I've heard people interviewing folks going, man, you can have a sovereign God and yet we're doing only what we will. And that just answers all the questions. Poor objector in Romans 9. Don't even know why Paul could have just said, you just don't understand middle knowledge. Come on. There's a way around this. That's why they got to do with it the way that they do. The sad thing is the result is this decree is no longer an expression, hence self-glorifying expression, of the triune God's eudaikia. It is now what he gets glorified for is being this supercomputer that you feed in all the data from middle knowledge. And that data from middle knowledge then allows him to understand which of the many possible worlds over here he can actually actuate. And then you have this idea that mankind is somehow free, but he's not. It's a really cheap freedom, because how can you really say, oh yeah, we've got man does whatever he wants to do, except God micromanages everything around him so he does only what God wants him to do. What kind of autonomy is that? Oh, but he's still free because of middle knowledge. So you end up with creatures who do what they do because God's put them in that situation, and they couldn't have done other because middle knowledge already said what they were going to do. And then you end up with a God whose decree is basically that of a quantum computer. You fed the stuff in, you ran the algorithm, And now his Yutakia becomes the output of a quantum computer. And we call it good. Okay. There you go. There you go. See why it's important? See why it matters? And automatically what happens at this point is people go, well, that's I've read such and so. Okay, all right. So what I would like to do, as we have time to do so, is I would like to use my Kindle edition of The Only Wise God by William Lane Craig, walk through what he says. And then if you want to use some other guys, I've got their Kindle books too. And if you think there's something where Craig has just missed it, or he didn't emphasize this properly or whatever, well, take a look at it. Why is it important? I honestly believe that when we allow Scripture to be that which determines the entire fabric of our worldview, rather than creating a worldview out of human philosophy and papering it with scriptural passages. There's a vast difference between those two things. There is a vast difference between creating your theology based upon the demands of the consistent application of solid hermeneutics to the entirety of Scripture, and coming up with something through the wisdom of your mind and attaching various Bible passages to it. Vast difference. And I think God is glorified when his truth is magnified. And I think God is glorified when we realize that this creation thankfully involves his grand provision for mankind, but it's not about us. It's not about us, and when we limit him to our categories, we do so to the detriment of his glory. Tremendously so. Tremendously so. So, there's some thoughts for today. Hopefully useful to you. Yes, sir.
So I have a takeaway on today's show.
Even though we do not have a Rich Cam, we do have a comment from the studio audience. I will attempt to communicate it to you.
So all you ever do is talk about war.
All I ever do is talk about war?
World War II.
Oh, yes.
You got to take the Twitter takeaway from today's show.
The Twitter takeaway, yes. The Twitter takeaway. Rich is telling us that his Twitter takeaway is that all I ever talk about is war, because I used illustrations from World War II and the Battle of Midway. And that's exactly how Twitter interprets everything. They hear a sentence and miss the whole rest of it. Yeah, that's pretty much how Twitter works. There's no question about it. Well, thank you for that, Rich. I appreciate that. That you are always very helpful along those lines. Very, very, very much so. All right. Well, boy, I can't even... No, those things are so small. It's unbelievable. Anyway, I'll hopefully be able to rescue my computer later on from the tiny, tiny fonts that are now afflicting me. Thanks for watching the program today. Lord willing, we will see you at our normal time on Thursday, whatever a normal time is for us. Who knows when that is? We do have the end of daylight savings time coming. Yay! Which only means we have to change our computations. We don't play with our clocks anyways, but... it's coming up this weekend, if you were wondering about that. But that means next week at a different time for you, but not for us. Thanks for watching. We'll see you. God bless.